Whenever we work with our clients in hypnosis, we use inductions to put our clients into hypnosis. And there are so many various kinds of inductions. There's the famous Elman induction. There are instant inductions. There are relaxation inductions that can take a long time. There are more indirect inductions. There are so many various inductions. Welcome to our episode on inductions in our mini-series on hypnotic techniques. My name is Axel Hombach. I'm a hypnotist and trainer for self-hypnosis in Cologne, Germany. I'm here in London with Dr. John Butler of the HTI, the Hypnotherapy Training International, one of the leading schools of hypnotherapy, especially the analytical hypnotherapy. Hello, John.
Hello, Axel. Hello to listeners.
You give a lot of courses, and just last week you gave your first of this group of four classes, four courses, and you talked and taught a lot about inductions, of various inductions, how important inductions is, how important language is, technique, etc. But not only technique, as we mentioned in our previous episode, it's not only technique, it's also the principles that goes with that.
Yes.
And induction as a hypnotic technique. From your 40 years of experience, what would you say is most important with inductions? What kind of inductions are there? Mm-hmm. What kind of approaches are there? The stage is yours.
Okay, thank you, Axel. Well, the induction of hypnosis, as it's called, which is engendering, through your interaction with the client, a trance-like state, a hypnotic trance. So it has several main components. And contrary to popular belief and many training courses, the technique used is very much the more minor factor. We often say in our courses that there is expectancy. Well, we start often with imagination. Well, expectancy, imagination, and then the technique that's used. The imagination, in the case of the stage hypnotist, may be stimulated by the posters that are put up around or the messages sent out on the internet that this well-known stage hypnotist is about to perform. This excites the imagination. When people are there then, if they're interested in going up on stage, there's an expectancy that they're going to have an unusual experience, that this person is competent. They expect to go into a trance. And then, really, the technique is very much a minor factor. And it is no different, in its essence, with the clinical practitioner. Client is stimulating their imagination by the knowledge, the abilities of the therapist when they're speaking to them, when they're having that discussion during the interview phase, and that very often they have come through a recommendation. And or the therapist talks about how the therapy helps the condition that the client is bringing. So all along, there's an imagination being developed here that I can be helped. This therapist knows what to do to help me. And I'm definitely going to be able to go into a trance to one degree or another, learn how to do that. And so expectation is built, then the technique is used.
What you say reminds me of something that I read long ago about Abbé Faria, when he practiced, that he was the person who discovered that when the clients came to him, they were already in trance.
Yes, their imagination is activated. We talk about suggestion, the suggestive influence. What we're doing here, now when we look at it, is that confidence, that belief, the person going into a trance, activates a natural capacity, which is the trance itself. We all have that power. We have the power of suggestion, we've got the power of trance. People go into different kinds of trances during the day, when they're daydreaming, watching an exciting film on the television or the cinema, and so on. So we can all go into this non-logical, non-analytical part of our brain, where we are using imagination, emotions more, coming up to the fore, and so on. It's the mind of intuition as well. We talk about the subconscious processes. Now, we are moving the client from conscious, directed, objective awareness of the external world and processing maybe some things in their own mind or how we're discussing things with them is activating their thinking processes. We're moving from that kind of processing into the non-logical, subjective, emotional responding, allowing the imagination to be free, to take the suggestions, the concepts that are being proposed, and now start to create mental and emotional, powerful, imaginative belief about this, that this can happen, I'm going to give up smoking, play better golf. We're embedding that idea then through stimulus response conditioning with words. As the recording is played, as the client uses their own suggestions, self-hypnosis. So a deep conditioning process is involved. Now, but let's stay with that introductory part. To get them into that state, Ellman said it's two main factors. We're moving the mind away from that thinking about the outside world. So he says we must bypass the critical factor, which is no longer now doing as much of that comparing, contrasting, analyzing of incoming data. We put that part of the mind aside slightly over there in another chair in the room. Well, in our mind, we're sitting in a different chair, and now we establish selective thinking. So those were the two main ingredients for Ellman to produce the trance, that defined the trance. Now, all trance is not hypnosis, and hypnosis involves more than a trance. You could be hypnotized without a trance in waking hypnosis. However, I don't want to complicate things at the moment. What people think of typically as a trance in the Western model, you ask the person to close their eyes, tell them their muscles are relaxing and each breath is taking them deeper into relaxation, and so on. To relax the body, which helps to reduce, again, thinking, to relax the mind. And so we then maybe use an imaginative scenario. Imagine you're lying on a beautiful beach, or you're walking out in the countryside among nature, and now you see they're using imagination rather than logical processing. And so that part of the mind is more accessible and open to being programmed. So really, the purpose of using hypnosis in this clinical setting is to tap into the subconscious processes, activate them, arouse them, and use them for therapeutic purposes, as opposed to being on stage where it's essentially entertainment. Can you do something funny like lose the numbers, counting from 1 to 10, to lose the number 5 maybe, or you tell them to forget their telephone number. You were at the class last week and a few of our students experimented with that with great success. It's not something we use clinically all the time, but they were using that kind of suggestion to the mind. But you must get the critical factor less active, less dominant. And so that is achieved by various types of induction. Now, last week on that Hypnotherapy Skills for a Life Change course, you saw me talk about 5 main types of induction.
Yes.
Main principles from which we derive main categories. And each induction that's practiced out there in the world at the moment is usually made up of one or more of those. Now, there are others, but they're less important for our present discussion. Those 5 principles include the use of shock, a startling command usually.
This sleep
that
command.
Sleep command usually.
It doesn't have to be sleep. It can be boo or
yes.
Ha or
yeah.
Something that is shocking the nervous system for a moment.
It could be a sound of a gong. It could be a clap of the hands very strongly. But usually the word sleep is used, and that has additional value because the word sleep is telling the person, relax your mind, stop thinking so much, just like you do when you're unable to get to sleep.
Just a historic remark, as far as I know, that goes also back to Abbe Faria, who shouted at the clients duerma, which is Portuguese for sleep.
Yes, of course. It's been known for a long time. And in the Western model of hypnosis for medical decorum and other reasons, as they moved away from the mesmeric trance, they began to use the hypnos concept, which hypnos being the Greek god of sleep. So telling the mind to go into a kind of a light sleep, the beginning stage of sleep. In fact, we know it's not sleep. James Braid, who popularized the use of the word hypnos, he used the terms neurohypnotism, a sleep of a part of the nervous system. So we invite the client, direct them, guide them, facilitate them to become less active in their thinking, as if they're going into the first stages of sleep. But we know instead of going towards sleep and to nocturnal type of sleep, they go into this very relaxed but very aware state, a hyper-aware state, yet more relaxed. And of course, because they're lying in a chair, very lethargic, they're not usually very focused on that increased awareness. but the mind is more sensitive, more aware to suggestions. Now, there's a lot that could be done with that hypnotic state. That is very fascinating. We don't use it all the time in clinical settings. As you know, in mentalism, there are very subtle clues given off as the mind changes, the mind-body interaction takes place, and you can read a lot of what's going on in the mind when you know how, and therefore influence the client. We're using that. But to keep it very simple, shock, number one principle. The second main principle in producing an induction is the use of loss of equilibrium, which can be mental equilibrium or physical equilibrium, and usually involves both, and it can be partial or complete. And as the client is taken off of their center of equilibrium, there's that loss of physical equilibrium induces a certain level of loss of mental equilibrium, mental control. And where their defense mechanisms, their ordinary everyday thinking is reduced, temporarily a little dislocated. And now, as long as they feel that the person, the hypnotist, is benevolent, a trustworthy figure, they're able to let go and then let themselves be guided into the trance very quickly, very powerfully in that way, and begin then to accept suggestions. Each suggestion that's accepted paves the way for the next acceptance of a suggestion. The third category is misdirection. Misdirection, again, can be mental or physical. Now, in the interest of saving time, I won't go into much detail about it here, but that is where an effect is produced. And to give a quick example, where the use of a locking up a muscle group in a way that the client can't, for example, open their eyes, where they attribute it to the effect of the suggestions the therapist is giving them, when in fact it is a physical effect. Nevertheless, because they've attributed it to the effect of suggestion, it helps to create a very helpful, powerful even induction. It's often used as part of the way it's often been used in stage hypnosis, with the locking of the hands over the head. And so the client initially thinks, oh, I'm going into a trance because I can't open my eyes or can't unlock my hands, or I'm responding with a suggestion, depending on whether it's part of an induction or not. The client now leaves themselves open voluntarily because they've agreed to the process. They're now able to move the critical factor further aside and go into a trance. So that can be done more quickly or slowly or in combination with other methods or several of those misdirection methods. And there are various forms of mental indirection or mental misdirection that are quite interesting, but again, we don't have really time for them here. Now, indirect methods are often very short, or they can be much longer. Typically, they take a longer time to use with a client. Erickson was famous for indirect methods, but in fact, if we look at his career, he usually used a combination of direct and indirect. And a good therapist is able to be direct or indirect or in between. So indirect can be very much the use of language you may find X, Y, Z happening. Or you can allow yourself to experience something and maybe there's not even a choice almost given to the client other than a story is told. And the story contains elements of suggestion, kind of metaphor-based, which is not necessarily indirect, the metaphor itself, but it can be used as an indirection. Now, the techniques of doing that require a lot of practice to make it effective, and it's often taught very superficially. Frankly, there's no great benefit that we can tell from the research that's been done that indirect, in general, is better than direct. In fact, it's often better to start with direct methods. And then, for clients who have some opposition or fear of directive suggestions, one can soften it and go more indirect. So there's a lot of variation in direct methods that you can bring into your work in giving suggestions as well as in the induction. So it's important to know that they're there for you, but they won't be the ones most commonly used. And certainly, while they were very popular 30 years ago, from the 80s onwards, when around the time Erickson passed away, and it became a dogma that direct suggestions were somehow, authoritarian in some negative way and were old-fashioned, people began to use indirect methods as a staple. And then that was not a good idea. And many clients actually prefer you to be clear and direct.
Also attributed especially to the Ericksonian approach are the confusion techniques.
Yes.
Is that related to indirect?
Well, it's actually separate, but often is linked with indirect. It can be used as part of indirection methods.
So it is probably overlapping because of the Ericksonian approach, or what is now called Ericksonian.
Yes. You keep swapping their mind between different types of suggestions you're giving them, consciously directed or subconsciously directed, and they get confused as what's the point of this? What am I can be aware, I'm aware, I'm not so aware, am I as aware as I think I'm aware,
You are confusing me now.
Already, yeah.
Oh, I must be in hypnosis now.
Well, your critical factor gets a bit confused and says, all right, I'm not going to try and follow this. And so we've moved it aside from being in a more dominant position. Anyway, confusion and direction often can be linked. The last category, last main category, are the relaxation-based approaches. And they are still so common.
I hear them very often when I buy a hypnosis MP3, for example. And usually it's a progressive relaxation method to bring the people in hypnosis.
This is a great mistake often. They're often misused, overused. They can be used as part of an induction. They can be used part of deepening, provided you know exactly what kind of scenario, for example, you might be using to help induce relaxation in the client. You might feel golf is very relaxing because you enjoy golf and you find your client is a golfer. And, you know, you immediately think, well, imagine you're out in the beautiful, golf links, you're beautiful summer's day, but he may be a person who gets very uptight when playing golf, gets frustrated easily. I mean, it's so easy to misjudge how people's minds react. Everybody is different, and we can feel confident of sometimes, I'll put the person into a relaxing scenario in their mind. So we have physical relaxation of the musculature, progressive muscular relaxation, and that's all fine up to a point, although very long-winded. Now you need to relax the mind because you've only so far relaxed the body. In so doing, often producing some mental relaxation, but we need more. So now you take him into some mentally relaxing scenario, but he may not like gardens. He may not like being out near the seaside as much as you believe or imagine he does. So again, Axel, one has to be careful and not make all these bland assumptions, these generalized assumptions people often make about relaxation methods. Relaxation typically takes maybe 20 minutes for it to be developed mentally and physically for many people. And all along, their mind may well be saying, well, I'm relaxing a bit, but I can hear everything. I'm still thinking a lot here. My mind is wandering, so I'm not hypnotized. And so without that steps and testing of the steps of hypnosis that a good hypnotist does automatically, and without working on the critical factor more effectively, you have a very, very superficial level of hypnosis. And that means the client is not really convinced.
And not in a state that is
usable
for us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So if we have tested it, if we've used a range of effective, starting with a very good induction for that person and adapting or changing another one if necessary for the client, then working with effective, appropriate suggestions, we have a good working level of trance where the client is much more convinced that they are experiencing something different from their everyday intellectual level of thinking and processing. So these are some of the key points about induction. And if we think very quickly at the shock, instant sleep, sound in a very powerful, direct way or a slightly milder way if necessary, all the way then from that heightened arousal of the mind down to the almost boring, monotonous, progressive relaxation, deeper and deeper, which kind of bores the mind and tells the conscious mind, firstly, there's nothing much going on, so you can easily take a little rest now. So we have those two poles, and we have methods in between. We have stages and ways of using the voice and the techniques that allow us to be very flexible in inductions. And combining one or more of them together, you could use an instant induction, and then you could combine that with all kinds of deepening methods, very similar to the Elman methods of deepening and getting catalepsy, going down into getting amnesia, the so-called somnambulism, and down to coma levels. So when you understand about inductions and what they're actually doing in the mind at the physical and mental levels, you can be very, very effective. You can produce the hypnotic state with a willing client very quickly. It's a joint process. They produce it with you. And it's when you look at the way hypnosis has been used in the past, they have mechanical aids, there's spirals, the inwardly spiraling pattern.
Or the lights, pendulum.
The pendulum, the watch, the
metronome. Or the golden ball pen.
All of the little tools, techniques have been used. But as Elman said, really, when you know enough about the trance, you can almost use anything. And that he called the catalyst method. When the client expects it, wants it, allows it, you may have set it up with them. At the moment, I'm going to use a handshake induction. I shake your hand, your right hand, three times. In the first shake, your eyes get heavy. In the second shake, they're closing, and they're closed. Now, in the third, they're closed, and they're locked. And the more you try and open them, the tighter the locking closed. If they've come to expect that, you're going to use the handshake induction, you see how quick and easy it is.
We talked now about the principles, several principles that all of the inductions incorporate in one or another matter. And it is very important to know those principles, how they work, so yes, that you can flexibly use them, mm-hmm, and even invent the induction on the spot that brings your client into this working state.
I'm going to use the blowing my nose induction with you today.
For example.
Pulling my ear.
Yep. Or when you have a cigarette, do it as Elman did. Well, that were other times, of course. Three puffs and the client was in deep hypnosis, like with the handshake induction that
absolutely
you just mentioned. But we wouldn't recommend using cigarette smoke today, of course.
No.
When I started with hypnosis many years ago, I learned the Elman induction.
Yes.
We had a script, a printout of the script, and we practiced reading the script and then hoping that the client goes into hypnosis.
Completely contradictory to what Elman stipulated and recommended.
What my experience was, I never really knew, is my, let's call it, in that situation, my victim really in hypnosis.
Yes.
And what happened, I took the class, I was good at reading the Elman induction, and I was very good at hoping that the client is in hypnosis. So a few weeks later, I went to a different workshop. I told everybody that I had learned hypnosis and everybody wanted to be put in hypnosis. So I said, no problem. We can do that tomorrow, because from my point of view, of course, I needed the script.
Mm.
I went into the hotel. I looked in the things I had with me and there was no script. I had forgotten the script.
Yes.
Who knows what my subconscious had intended with that.
Okay.
So I went back. I knew I had to deliver. I couldn't back out anymore. And I did the Elman induction for the first time without script. I knew the steps of the induction. I went through it. And this was the first time that I had the impression that my client really goes into hypnosis.
Absolutely.
So, with that said, it's not only important to know the various principles of hypnosis, it's also very, very important, as you said in our previous episode, the mindset, the energy, and what comes with that.
That comes through you three in your verbal and nonverbal. And as a good hypnotist, you learn the power of language, the best use of semantics and syntax, the structure and the use of language and the vocal expression, Do you use gestures, nonverbal? You may be using some of those methods. They seem old-fashioned to many hypnotists, but they're actually very helpful. You saw that for a whole morning, I trained the class, took up several volunteers in the use of the two-finger modified version of the Dave Elman induction. The modification was made by Gil Boyne. And you see, and again, in the Elman's work, he does modifications of his own methods as well. Very similar to that one.
Well, if you listen to Elman's recordings, then you will realize he never used the same induction twice.
That's right. He always
modified it.
There was always some improvisation in Elman, some change because of the client, how fast, how slow they were responding. Mm-hmm. He looked at something about their mental or physiological responses and would tweak the induction accordingly.
Yeah.
So that's a real practitioner.
Because he knew the principles of induction and he was a master at each of those principles and knew how to combine them. And also, when you listen to him,
Yes. You
can clearly hear that he is absolutely convinced that his client will go into hypnosis. There's no doubt in his voice.
That's right.
And that, of course, is what the subconscious mind of the client picks up. And he knows,
pick it up.
I'm secure with this guy. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. When you're hesitating, when you're in doubt, fear they won't respond and the therapist will feel embarrassed and rejected, maybe the client will criticize them, they have a whole range of fears. Well, then you can't be a good practitioner. So you must practice and learn and understand the subject at a deep level. It means you've got to find good training so you achieve that. And if you haven't got that properly during your training, you're at a big disadvantage. When you go out into the world, yes, you'll get opportunities to practice and work with people. However, if you're starting on the wrong foot, you may well be thrown by some of the experiences. People saying, well, I wasn't hypnotized, you know, you didn't get me under. And you don't even know yourself how to deal with that objection, because some people do expect to be unconscious or knocked on the head almost, which is not how hypnosis works. But when you don't understand your subject, you won't be able to maximize the responses with all of these different people. I would say one aspect of good inductions is always testing that they're going into trance. More for the client seeing through the tests that they're passing, that they're achieving a state.
As convincers.
Absolutely. When their eyes won't open, when they go down to the next test as part of the trance induction. These are very, very, very vital, in my opinion, for good practice.
Before we come to an end, one last point about the importance of technique. How detailed does a technique has to be? We mentioned before that Elman always adapted his induction to the client, so he was very flexible.
Yes.
And I remember from my early trainings that, for example, in your training, when I did that many years ago, you emphasized very much the hand drop induction, or what is now known as the hand drop induction.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, as far as I remember, one of the inductions that Gil Boyne brought to perfection.
Yes.
You showed that various times, and every time you worked with someone, it was slightly different.
Yes.
Nevertheless, from the course, the participants, they insisted on, how do I hold my hand correctly?
Yes.
Does it have to do this angle or that angle? How do I position my chair? Which angle do I have to have with my client? How do I hold my hand when he presses? Do I use more the fingertips or the hand palm?
Yes.
And there were always the questions, how exactly do I do that? I know from other courses
Yes. That
the trainers insisted of very, very, very precise techniques.
Yes.
And they emphasized the angle of the hand, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is your opinion to that?
Well, I believe technique needs to be at a very high level of proficiency, very professional, precise in that sense, but not rigid. And that's the difference. What they're saying is, this is how you do it. However, if I'm working with a client who's 19 stone weight, and he's positioned the chair at a certain angle, and I can look and see, well, because of the design of the chair and which way I want him to move forward, if I'm putting the hand away as part of the loss of equilibrium, I will have to adapt the position of my hand and adapt his position for that to be maximally effective. If I stay with the same rigid formula all the time, that can't happen. I will have a much poorer response. He may even feel uncomfortable when I take on my hand because I haven't taken the therapist, in this case myself, if it had been that person, hasn't taken into account his large abdomen, the size of his body, and the fact that he's now going to go into a very uncomfortable position when I take away the hand. So you see, Axel, it's having the wonderfully precise understanding about the technique as far as possible, then having the technique in its physical aspects very precise, and then very adaptable, like a great actor, a great musician, you're responding in the moment. In martial arts, we talk about counter-punching, all this improvisational ability that means you're really reading the situation, the client, physically, mentally, and where you're needing to take them as part of the induction. So you see, you could not have just that one position for the hand. It would be highly inappropriate. And very much the same with martial arts. When a person learns rigid techniques only and learns in that mechanic, well, the opponent on the street, for example, he's not following the same rule book. In fact, that's the nature of a good fighter. He's going to throw you. He's going to come out from a different position, an angle you never expected, and then it's all over. Because you are only able to respond to one given situation, one given approach from the other person. And that's just not the way therapy works. People are very individual as human beings.
And with that, it's the same with the technique than with the principles. It's important that you know the principles of the induction, of that various stages of the induction, and then adapt them to the individual case.
Yes, yes. We see people on YouTube doing an instant induction, which is really the work of Gil Boyne, if people were to give the credit where it's due, you know, rather than simply plagiarize.
They never do.
Yeah. Now, you'll see them do things there that are not actually all that, what shall we say, healthy for the client. They may put strain on the client's neck. They may do a movement that could cause problems. They're not following very good technique. Now, they don't understand maybe what it is that starting Clemande is meant to achieve at the physiological level. And that came a lot from the work of Pavlov, and Gil Boyne designed this modern era of instant inductions. He was influenced by Pavlov, behavioral psychology, several sources, stage hypnosis, much from his own experience. He put it all together to make this very full, precise induction called the instant induction. What it does at the brain level and peaking your nervous system, what changes there as they then are in that first kind of fight, flight, freeze mode, usually the freeze, shock. What happens to the brain right after that? On what point you're bringing in your suggestion. So in other words, the neurology and the physiology, when you know what the induction is really doing, you're no longer a mechanic in that sense, and just a very totally technical, on the superficial, visible levels of technique. You're not operating on that level only. And so your effects are much, much more powerful.
Thank you very much, John. And as usual, when we are coming to an end, your challenge, please summarize that in 4 to 5 sentences.
All right. Well, as best I can.
Of course.
The induction, the production of the trance, which is a natural phenomenon, needs to achieve 2 or 3 main factors within the mind, 2 or 3 main changes. Moving the critical factor aside, the mind then becoming wrapped around this suggestion, this selective thinking, as Ellman said. It can involve several principles to help get the conscious mind to move aside and open it up. And that includes those 5 methods that I mentioned. Shock, loss of equilibrium, misdirection, then the confusional and indirect methods, and the relaxation methods. A good client, a good subject, will respond very well, provided the therapist is confident and has the ability to generate expectation, imagination, and then deliver a very high quality technique that they understand well, and then deliver very precisely and adaptively to the client success is virtually certain. And if there's inhibitions, then they can deal with that.
Thank you very much, John. And I'm already looking forward to talk to you about our next episode, which is idiomotor responses.
Okay, that's a good topic. Thank you, Axel, and thanks to our listeners.